my dear friends, the purpose of this session is to have some kind of a view of developments in American synagogue music and Jewish music in general, and to see some features that we can identify in recent American music, and to ask ourselves where this leads to, and what are we, what can we think about, and what can we do with this music. Now, I must say that, and I must confess that is, that in part I'm not a great lover of all what's going on in America. There is too much, to my opinion, of catering to pop music, and too much shallow thinking when it comes to music. That does not mean that pop music does not have a place. In other words, pop music does have a place and can be used in the service. But if the service is based only on pop music, we are in a problem. And the problem is that while we are trying to give the congregation lots of music to sing, we may end up with a quite low common denominator for that kind of music, and the demands of the congregation will be to even lower the standards, to lower the standards even more and more and more and more. And that is what is really happening. And so I must confess that I'm a bit biased. That I'm a bit biased in this matter. And I must ask your forgiveness about that. Maybe somebody else who would present the entire scenery in a different manner would be much more, would give a much lovelier scene in what's going on in America. It all began in the 1960s. In the 1960s, you remember, America was facing the Vietnam War. Towards the end of the 60s, things became worse and worse. And the youth started to rebel. Now, of course, it's debated whether we have here an effect of the chicken and the egg. Did the youth rebel before, and it manifested itself in the reaction to the Vietnam War? Or did the Vietnam War bring about this kind of reaction? I think the things are together, interwoven together, and we cannot think separately about the anti-establishment sentiments which were rising from the 1950s on, and on the one hand, and the Vietnam War. But in any case, the it is quite clear that there was a demand for changes, not only in the synagogues, but also, and I must say even more so, in the churches. And these changes were dealt with by various groups of leaders in various churches, and I must signify above and beyond every other group the contribution of the Vatican to this problem. Now, the Vatican convened in 1962 to a convention which is called Vatican Number 2. The first Vatican convention was in the 15th century, Vatican I, of that kind of a the counter. It was a reaction against the Reformation, and it was a counter-reformation, and they wanted to mend the church from inside. Now came the time after many, many hesitations, that the leaders of the church wanted to have major changes in various liturgical aspects in order to bring the congregations back to the church. And one of the things that they were thinking about was music, the music of the church. Until then, prayers were sung or chanted or said in Latin, and only in Latin. And the music of the church was either very old Gregorian chant or compositions that were written for the church and were approved by the church according to the criteria of the what we call the Trent the Trent Committee or the Trent Reform in the 16th century. And they had to be written in a certain way, and they were not supposed to be overly dramatic, etc., etc. I don't want to go into detail. But in any case, the idea was now to open up the church for changes and to allow various kinds of music in. And when we talk about various kinds of music, the idea was to go to the people. What do people want? What is the tendency among young people? What kind of music do they want? What do they want from prayer? So the entire situation in the church changed. First of all, in architecture, there was a symbol. In previous times, the altar in the church was facing the wall where the crucifix was standing. Now, they moved the altar forward to the congregation, and the priests, instead of facing the crucifix, they faced the congregation. So that was a major change, and it was symbolic. And then the idea was to change from Latin to the vernacular. Well, of course, the Protestants did that a few centuries ago, centuries before that, and they prayed in the vernacular. But the idea was to, on the part of the Vatican, is to not join forces with the Lutherans, but on the contrary, to show that we have our own way of facing the people, we have our own prayers, our own services, etc., etc. On the other hand, what we do want is to receive our youth, and therefore they agreed to allow pop music or any kind of fashionable music into the church. And that caused a big revolution. But that was not enough. If we see what the situation in the Catholic Church was, we see that in spite of the fact that the doors opened, there were many groups who were still not satisfied with what was going on in the church, because for them everything was too big. The church was big, the buildings were big, the services were with many people, and what they wanted to do is to have a more intimate kind of service and a more intimate connection with God. So various groups were formed in Europe and in the United States, where people would gather into small churches or even at homes, or even more, in some cases, people like people in monastic institutions were trying to open up their doors and allow the layman to come in, and in addition to that, try to find ways to present a service of the heart rather than a formal service, to have a service of the heart. So for instance, in Thésée, in northern France, on the Switzerland border, they opened up a kind of a place like that, and they had international meetings about this problem. People came, Catholics and Protestants and even Jews came to study what can be done about simplifying the services, having an immediate and not an intermediate relationship with God. So that was happening in all places. Now bring the Catholic example, because that one is the most documented and the most advanced for that day. Now, in addition to changing the altar and so on and so forth, the architecture of churches changed. And rather than building big buildings or very high buildings, people built churches which are more community centers like, rather than churches. And the music fitted that kind of situation. People sat around and sang songs. People brought all sorts of instruments, guitars mainly, but not only guitars. Some churches adopted instruments from Africa. And the music changed radically and was simplified a lot. Some of the music was repetitive. That means like a mantra. And that was the influence of the yoga movements, going to the East and learning Hindu practices and so on. Everything opened up for that kind of thing. There was art music in the churches, and people still composed music which was on a say more classical level, but by and large there was less and less composition written in that style. So this is the situation in the churches. What is the situation in the synagogues? Very similar. There was no decision from above to change synagogue music, because that does not fit anything in Jewish life. And on the contrary, if somebody would decide to change something, immediately people would react against it. So that's very Jewish. So this did not happen. What did happen was that people were looking for more intimate ways of communicating with God and with the community, with the fellow people. Therefore, people assembled in smaller synagogues or in even smaller groups, which were called chavura. And they had prayers, not necessarily in a synagogue, but they went to nature, had a Shabbat service in a forest or in another beautiful place. They they used in a fall movement, they used very simple musical instruments, sometimes rejected even musical instruments, and the prayers varied from very strict Orthodox chaburot who were bound to the text exactly as the halakha provided, to reform groups which tried to change everything, the text, the music, and so on. The synagogues changed in America very much, and there was a movement from big synagogues and synagogues that were built, say, in the end of the 19th century or beginning of the 20th century, which were quite huge, with a big organ and a choir and so on, like Temple Emmanuel in New York, to smaller synagogues, and the smaller synagogues tended to be built more in suburban areas. And the suburban synagogue changed its architecture from a place which is, say, a floor for the synagogue, huge and high ceiling and so on, and a basement where there was the social activity of the congregation. This was the way it is done in the older synagogues. Two synagogues which were built in such a way that you had a synagogue social hall together. That means that on Shabbat you have a synagogue which is quite small, relatively speaking, and a big social hall behind it. And you had doors that opened. Opened, so you can always use it as a social hall. On the high holidays, the social hall became synagogue. So it was very practical, but that meant, from a musical point of view, that the ceilings were low, and the acoustics was only good if you had amplifications, and the musical instruments that went well with the amplifications were, say, guitars electric guitars, things like that, organs, but not the regular organs. There was no money for organs, but electric organs, and so on and so forth. So the entire musical scene also went into change with that. In spite of that, there were various groups who did not like praying in the synagogues at all, because they claimed that the synagogues were not friendly to them. So that was the idea. Synagogues were not friendly to them. Now, this process was a long one, from the 1960s to the beginning of the 21st century. Now, towards the beginning of the 21st century, some people in America tried to find some solutions to some of the problems that were raised. And Lawrence Hoffman, Rabbi Dr. Lawrence Hoffman of the Hebrew Union College in New York, masterminded a movement which was called Synagogue 2000. And the idea of Synagogue 2000 was to make the synagogue as friendly as possible to the people. And he and a group of his co-workers wrote a manual, a thick manual, of how to make the synagogue more friendly. And that dealt with every aspect of the synagogue, from the parking lot to the music. That means, for instance, let me put it a different way. Some of this idea was inspired by the black churches. Well, the synagogues, the committees or like that, took notice that while the synagogues are are becoming empty by the time, black churches are filled to capacity. And therefore, the question was asked, what do they do that we do not do? And can we learn from them? So, they found out, for instance, that in the black churches, when you come to the parking lot, somebody is there at the parking lot to greet you and say hello and say something in the name of Jesus or something to greet you and welcome you and bless you as you come to the synagogue. The synagogue is becoming very, very, to the church. And the church is becoming very, very friendly this way. And so on and so forth. They took notice of what these mega churches, so they are called mega churches, were doing, and tried to imitate some of the features. And among other things, they saw that the music in the churches is very lively. People are singing in rhythm, and everything is wonderfully. Everybody is wonderfully happy in the churches. And why can't we have the same thing in a synagogue? So all of these things brought the changes in music. Brought the changes in music, and gradually composers started writing music which was more, say, in agreement with the new ideas. But the composers now came from a different area. Until then, until the 1960s, most of the composers came from classical music. Now, there are still composers coming from classical music, but many composers come from pop music, from various kinds of music, which is, has to do with the movies, the Broadway theater, and so on. So that is the scene. And now, let's go a little bit into the music itself. First of all, we need to know that in the 1960s, one of the avenues of being popular and enjoying popularity was the Israeli avenue. And that was very strong after the 1967 war. After the 1967 war, Israel was above everything else in the minds of Jews of America, the Jews of America. And I cannot forget my experiences at that time. I came to the United States after the 67 war, and I was welcomed as a hero. It was very difficult to convince them that all I did during the war was to play in the army band, and even that they didn't get me for the war. I mean, there was no time to get the army band to do anything during that war. So I didn't do a thing. But I was a complete hero there in the United States.
You won.
Yeah, right. I shouldn't complain. But what was very bizarre to me is whenever you came to a synagogue and you heard a sermon of a rabbi, there was no talk about social justice or any religious aspect from observing the Shabbat to any other thing which has to do with theology or philosophy. Everything concentrated on Israel. And therefore, the Israeli music or music written in Israeli style caught on very well. And so, what I would like to you to hear is a composition which is actually a part of a service written by Avraham Kaplan. Avraham Kaplan, in a booklet which is called Psalms of Avraham. And that is Hinei Matov Umanaim Shevet Achim Miyachat, Psalm 133. So it's a nice performance, and it's the Vienna Boys Choir singing it in this performance. But that was a gift to the United States by a composer who is originally Israeli. Avraham Kaplan was very famous as a choir conductor in Israel before he emigrated to the United States, and he has been living there for many, many years. So here is the piece. Now notice, please, how many words you have here. So at last minute, he is reminded, Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. Okay? Hinei Matov Yanaim, Shevet Achim Gam
Yachad.
Huh? Very nicely composed. He's a professional composer. He's so he knows what he does. So I return to this thing about how many words you put in a composition, because it's a major factor in compositions of later times. Another composer who gets his inspiration from Israel is Bon Yashur. Now, you've met Bon Yashur. Bon Yashur was born in Lithuania. He served during World War II in the Russian army, and after that he went to Israel. He was for a number of years a member of a kibbutz, and then he immigrated to the United States and was a composer at various synagogues, a music director of various synagogues, and after a number of years, he became part of the teaching staff in Cincinnati of the HUC, and he became what is called the professor of liturgical arts, so they called it, in Cincinnati. And there, he had a tremendous influence on a whole generation of rabbis who heard his music, learned his music. He taught Jewish music, but his classes of Jewish music were, I must say, foremost Bon Yashur's music. So he had a tremendous influence, and many synagogues played his music or sang his music for many times. I must say that he did some other very important things at Hebrew College. He reinstalled the cantillation, the Tamei Mikra, in the Reform movement, and did some very important things in that. He arranged many, many Israeli songs for use in synagogues, and fought for the idea that American synagogue music should be influenced by the music of Israel, because the music of Israel symbolizes the renewal of Jewish aspirations from biblical times, and it is different from the music of the Galut, of the exile. And so, for him, if you sing na 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 na, that is the exile, and should be abolished. He was not the only one who thought this way. A whole generation of Israeli composers did think this way. So he composed in the Israeli style, and here is a very important composition by him. It's called the Hallel Songs, and it is performed regularly each year, once a year, in Cincinnati, and is a very favorite piece of music. It's very well written and has some experimental dimensions to it. Very Israeli style. Israeli pop song, popular song. Notice the rhythms. Sorry. Notice the rhythmical patterns and the repetition of the rhythmical patterns. Bonya wanted to see the Canaanites in the Israeli. For him, Israeli. For him, the spirit of Israel is not in the religious Jewish interpretation of the Torah and things like that, but the what was very common in Israel to think at that time, even earlier, and that is the Canaanite element of Israel. We have to return to that kind of element, which was probably very prominent in biblical times and had some elements of paganism. So this kind of hallelujah was very important for him, and it contradicted the general Jewish thinking about religion. He has a Micha Mocha, which for Shabbat morning, which goes Micha Mocha Ba'elim Adonai, Micha Mocha Nedar Ba'Kodesh, Nolat Eilot Osefele, Yahad, 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 Kulam, Kulam, Hodu v'im lichu v'yamru. And now comes Adonai Yimloch le'olam v'ed. Adonai Yimloch, Adonai Yimloch le'olam v'ed. Adonai Yimloch, Adonai Yimloch, and so it goes on for a long time. And the idea is to represent, say, the Israelites on the shores of the sea, dancing and singing, but not in a way, in a Jewish way, so to speak, but in a very pagan way. Very close to earth. Very close to earth. That is...
I like
Kedusha is a simpler thing that he did. I'll talk about it in a minute. But this was very popular, and it's still very successful in the synagogue when you do it. Especially a piano accompaniment is simple, but it is very sophisticated and calculated to give you that kind of expression of paganism.
Did he write whole services from beginning to
end? He did not write whole services, but he wrote pieces. And you come back. The Hallel was written whole, the whole thing. The Hallel was written whole.
So if you use this music, you have to combine it with more traditional melodies.
No, you can take any piece that you want from the service. No, you don't have to do.
So he composed music for all the whole services, for one full service, for instance.
No, he didn't. He never composed one, except for the Hallel. He did not compose a full service like a Friday night service or Shabbat. He has a Shabbat service which is really combined for various pieces that he wrote during the ages. Yeah, not as a unit.
But it's his music.
Yeah. And so this is very typical of that kind of thinking, and it caught on in America very well because of a few things. Number one, there was an urge to kind of body movement. If the mega churches could do it, because the singing in black churches was very much there's corporal, there's body movement, there is clapping of hands and things like that. Therefore, we could also have that kind of thing. So Bonya wrote some of these compositions in this manner, and other compositions he wrote in a more popular vein. Many of his compositions he wrote on demands of students. Students wanted a certain piece they needed for a service that they planned. So he wrote many pieces like that. One of these pieces is the Kedusha. Nekadesh et shimcha ba'olam כשם שמקדישים אותו בשמי מרום, ככתוב היד נביאך, וקרא זה זה ואמר, קדוש, קדוש, קדוש. I must tell you that when I first heard this Kedusha, I was shocked. I was totally shocked. And I was not the only one. This kind of thing. But the idea of a Kedusha is not this kind of music. Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot, Melocho Haaretz, Kevodo. And we have Kadosh, and you go up, Kadosh, Kadosh. You are, the idea of Kedusha is to bring you up as high as you can. This Kedusha was written in a manner which is similar to what we call sea shanties. That means sailor songs. This is, in a way, an anti-kedusha from the point of view of classical music, classical Jewish music. But that caught on very well, just because it was like that, just because it was something familiar, something that brings down the entire kedusha down to earth, and something that people could identify with without to have some kind of obligation towards something higher than yourself. So that is why people related to it immediately very well. Bonya always tells a story about how he composed the Kedusha and how he himself had regrets about this piece, that he didn't know what's going to happen with it, or that he should totally forget it, and so on. And the students, the rabbinic students of Hebrew Union College, encouraged him to proceed with that. Let's move on to another composer, and that is Stephen Richards. You may know this piece. How many of you know this piece? Okay?
Yeah.
Not, this is one,
not in this form, but it's familiar.
Oh, yeah.
You should know,
you
should know that this kind of, this is a kind of Broadway style. This is the most, I would say now, the most popular synagogue piece in America that you can ever have.
Really?
And it is, and people are demanding of the cantors to sing it all the time. I would say maybe in the last two or three years it's gone down in popularity for other pieces, but it still is maintaining a very high popularity among. So now, what about this?
What do you think about
it? It's sentimental. It's on the one hand very moving and appealing. On the other hand, it's sometimes too sugary for me. But that's my own
okay.
My own problem. Don't mix up my problems with that. Ratzei Adonai Eloheinu.
We wondered, was it a boy or was it a girl?
No, a female.
Male.
Male.
Male. Male.
Female voice. Now, this is the image of Israel after the Yom Kippur War. The image of Israel in American music changed. It's also changing Israeli music. You have music which becomes very sentimental after the Israeli war. There's less macho in the Israeli music, and so is also the relationship of American musicians to Israel. There's more tenderness, there's more sentimentality in that music, and what people who are used to kind of Zionist songs and so on can detect is Hamachazir Shchinato LeZion, that kind of Zionist longing and yearning for the country, for Israel, is very evident here, and this is one of the reasons why it was so popular and still is. But that's another aspect of Israeli songs that influenced the Israeli concept or concept about Israel that influenced the music of American synagogues. By and large, I must say that the interest in Israel after the Yom Kippur War went down from American Jewish congregations. It went down. As long as Israel was very successful and, you know, on the horse, everything was fine. But once Israel was a little bit more, came down to normal sizes or it was in itself a little bit depressed, then the American congregations are not very much interested. But they are interested in that kind of sentiment still. that kind of music is sentimental, very sentimental kind of music, and that caught on as one aspect of popular synagogue music. And I want you to hear another composition that you may know very well. I don't know how much you have sung it.
Where can we find the sheet music of the recording of
Transcontinental Music has all of this.
Transcontinental Music.
.com.
.com.
Right.
Okay. They have a lot, very lot.
Yeah. 23, it's the last. You may know it, but that is another aspect of sentimental Jewish writing for services. This is by Cantor Meir Finkelstein.
Oh, yeah.
course, the oohs are very important here. The oohs that accompany behind the choir. Of it, this kind of sentimentalism that became more and more after the 1970s, mostly for many reasons, the Israeli situation, but also the need, the craving of people for more intimacy in the prayer. So you have this aspect, and what is happening in the meanwhile is that we are subject to a new brave world, and that is the Aquarius, the Age of Aquarius. And the Age of Aquarius means that we are thinking a bit differently, and we are not anymore in a kind of a direct kind of thinking, but we are more into meditation, into intuition, less into logical thinking, and the synagogues want that kind of thinking. And so the youth especially wants to have this kind of sentiment by having simple melodies which are repetitious. So you can have a melody like Kaplan's Hinematov Umanaim, but to the nth degree. For instance, if you have a melody like Elohai Neshama Shenatata Bitehorahi. Elohai Neshama Shenatata Bitehorahi. Now that the atmosphere that this melody creates is not necessarily sitting in a synagogue in rows or pews, but sitting around a campfire with marshmallows and singing together. And what is more appropriate in this case is that you always have a second line. Elohai neshama shenatata bi tehorai tehorai, and people go like around. They sing the first part and the second part, and then those two parts together, and they sing it many, 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 many times in a synagogue to such an extent there is no time to say the entire prayer of Elohai neshama shenatata bi. Only you say, you only say the first words. And these are repeated like a mantra, and that comes from this new age thinking, this new age sentiment that people want to embody in the prayers. And I'm not talking about, I can't identify with that, but I'm not trying to tell you what's wrong, but I'm trying to tell you what's happening, like a phenomenon. And that is happening all the time now, and many more melodies are composed in the same manner. For instance, one of the most recent ones, I'm sure that there are many more since that one, is Ashrei Yoshvei Betecha. It goes, Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, Od Yahalelucha, Od Yahalelucha, Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, Od Yahalelucha, Od Yahalelucha, Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, Od Yahalelucha, Od Yahalelucha. And so the, even to the word Selah, it does not come, but it is repeated many, many times. The people identify with that kind of repetition. So in here's another one of these that you may know. This is taken from a record which is called Shabbat Beyachad, a CD, Shabbat Beyachad. And it is a recording of the Westchester County Temple in the New York area, in the New York area, in which people pride themselves of the intimacy of prayer and that they are singing a lot. So let's hear the first piece. Composer is Shefa Gold. She is a rabbi in the, and she wrote many, many melodies like that. Okay. So you hear that repetition. You hear the repetition of you hear the things which in accompaniment you hear something which sounds either like bells or like more like a sitar, an accompaniment of an Indian sitar, and that's the idea. You get into the kind of a
something like I don't know how to call it.
Saranji.
Something like this. You pull it and there is air and you pull it back.
Harmonica.
Harmonica. It's not harmonica.
Okay, so it's like a kind of Indian music that is here as the model of the music. So now you cannot talk about these tendencies, these trends, without two people. Just a minute, don't people, okay? Without two people. One is Jeff Klepper. Jeff Klepper, and the other one is Debbie Friedman. Let's hear Moderni by Jeff Klepper. Thank you. So we know that, and okay, that's stop. So this opens the services on Shabbat morning. Yes, this opens the services Shabbat morning at that temple. Now here the children sing it, but the adults are very happy to sing it. What did you do when Mode ani lefanecha shechezartaha bin mishmahati? What did you do? You clap. Okay. So the musicians call it, not the musicians who write it, but the musicians who are opposed to it, they call it the happy clappy style.
Seriously, I'm really curious because sometimes when I hear melodies from now, I think, oh, they sometimes sound like hymns out of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century, our synagogue hymns. But I wonder how people will listen to our music in 100 years?
That's a very good and interesting question, because let me in a minute I'll talk about that. But I want to hear before that the other piece, and that is Debbie Friedman's piece, one of the pieces.
Mishabeha.
Okay. Okay.
Except when we were in San Diego last year. David Friedman got an award. She was brought in by two people who almost carried her because she's so ill. And then they said, "You sit here, we'll sing this for you." That was very, very emotional. Very emotional. Yeah.
Okay, now. So please notice a few things. The music, but also the language. First of all, note the equality of the sexes. Mishaberach imoteinu, Mishaberach avoteinu, Mekor habracha leimoteinu. Our fathers and our mothers. And in second time, it's our mothers and our fathers. So nobody is hurt. Everything is kind of, how can I say, politically correct. And then the music begins with Hebrew, moves to English, which people understand. Hebrew they don't understand. And then notice the music. Slow music, which you can move slowly to as a community. Everybody is holding hands and moving from one side to another.
There's somebody who's ill in the neighborhood, in the family, whatever. It's always very emotional. Mm-hmm.
and that's repeated many times. And the idea of healing in a synagogue has become very, very prominent now. In especially in American thinking, the synagogue is a place for healing. You come to the synagogue to seek healing of the community, or healing of your family, or healing of yourself. Therefore, the Mishaberach for the sick has become a major thing, and lots of new songs are written around the Mishaberach for the sick people, and has become a very, very important part of the service. Now, notice that the music is very sentimental, very what the critics call touchy-feely. So what you can say about the music that has been written now in American synagogue music mostly is music that moves on two poles. One is happy-clappy, and the other one is touchy-feely. It has moved like that, and it is a congregational singing. Cantorial music is less and less written these days, and the congregations are more in favor of a song leader than a professional cantor. I'm not talking about all the congregations. The big congregations, like say Emmanuel or a congregation, big congregations in Texas or Chicago, or these things that still have this love for classical Jewish music. They combine classical music with other forms like popular songs and so on. But the smaller congregations go for that kind of thing. But not only that. In the bigger congregations, the fashion now is to have a number of services concurrently. So if you go to Kabbalat Shabbat, in a Temple Emmanuel in San Francisco, you go to three different services, or four different services, or Temple Israel in Detroit, which I attended. You go to three or four services. There is one which is called the central service, and that is a celebration services for bar and bat mitzvah people. Then there is a minyan of people who want to learn Torah, and they are like a chavura, like a small chavura, and they are not interested in what's going on in the other congregation. And then you have the big services, which are sometimes during summer times, not in the synagogue even, but on the grass in front of the synagogue. People are sitting there, and these are pop songs. And gradually, these replace the central synagogue services. So this is the situation right now. Now, the question is, what is happening? What will happen in a few days? Let me answer Misha's question, and that is, it is very interesting to see what is really happening to Debbie Friedman's song, or to Jeff Klepper's song. The newer generation does not recognize Jeff Klepper's song as an innovation, but rather as nusach. They see it as nusach, and already Jeff Klepper is outmoded. That means, oh, that is the old people's songs. That's trad, so to speak. TRAD dot. So that
trad
is
dot out old, yeah.
Yeah. So that is, in a way, for the younger people, already passé. The man who complains bitterly about these things is Bon Yeshua. He feels completely out of it Debbie Friedman is considered the music of the middle generation, not of the youth.
Well, you have to realize that the music composers now come from the game of music.
the game music. The people who compose the music for the computer games.
So, so this is already. Do you understand what I'm saying? I have no idea what's going to be in. I myself am a believer in cycles, but that's a different story.
Where would you position Zoe?
Zim? Okay. Zim is a populist. He's a great talent. One of the greatest talent in cantorial music that existed. And when he sings Chazanut, as Chazanut, he is one of the greatest that you can hear. However, most of his stuff is very nice. It's not that popular. In other words, not that kind of style of popular. It's more in Hasidic style, popular, and more akin to, say, Karlibach tunes. Like that. And some of them are very, very good. And others are repetitious.
And where will you put Dani Masek?
Okay, Dani Masek is a new formation. Dani Masek you cannot put in one place because some of his compositions, like Elohai Netzor Lishoni Merah, written in kind of jazzy style, is an excellent piece by itself. But his Matovu is too repetitious. Too many times Matovu. Yeah. Okay. Okay. We will not go through all of them. We want to see the trend. What is really happening in that now? In the Catholic churches, I started with the Catholic churches. I have to continue with the Catholic churches in order to understand what is happening. In the Catholic churches, they are now having second thoughts about this trend, and they are thinking that there is not enough intellectual. Intellectual work in this kind of music for the churches, and that a whole heritage of Catholic music that was created for centuries went down the drain with this kind of music, and so now there are people in the Catholic Church, mainly musicians, who are trying to find a way, a middle way, between the popular music and the traditional church music. And there is a group, for instance, in Chicago that is working very hard into creating a new hymnal, a new book of hymns, which will be on a higher level than the hymns that appeared so far in the church. There is even a stronger reaction of some other Catholic people. There is a man by the name of Thomas Day, who is... church musician, and he wrote a scathing book called Why Catholics Cannot Sing. And he says that with the entire atmosphere of Vatican II turning the churches into social halls, he calls them garages, turning, instead of building a church, they build a garage, which is supposed to have the people there. The architecture and all that goes with it failed miserably, and now the Catholics who were able to sing masses and so on very beautifully now cannot sing, and therefore we have to turn the trend not only in the music but everything that goes with that kind of music. Now I am a firm believer in cycles. We have seen that time and again. You know that Bach, in his own time, was considered passé in the Protestant church. He was considered a kind of an old man who can offer nothing to the world but this kind of old-style writing. And he was forgotten. For many years, Bach was forgotten. Until Mendelssohn came and revived his music. And from then on, people started seeing, oh my God, what kind of a genius that is, and what he did for the religious music of the Protestant Church. And there are all the time there are trends like that. You become more and more sophisticated, and sometimes too sophisticated for the public, and then you have a reaction against it. And then once you go down and into a lower kind of a more appealing kind of style, then what happens is that you're starting to think after a while, starting to think, what am I? You know, we like in the synagogues, we are a public of doctors, lawyers, accountants, I don't know, all sorts of things, professionals, and so on. We are quite high there intellectually, and yet when we come to the synagogue, what we want to do is leave our brains in the garderobe before we enter the synagogue, and subject ourselves to very low kind of music and very low kind of preaching. By the way, the preaching in America is becoming very, very low. And you hear, I had once a sermon about how my aunt told me how to make latkes for Hanukkah. Believe me, I heard this kind of sermon. The whole thing is going down, and there's going to be a reaction against it. So people will say, oh, come on, are we morons? Are we idiots? Why can't we have a more sophisticated kind of music, things? What happens to the entire heritage of many years of music making? So maybe we should go back to some of it. We'll never go back to the same kind of chazanut that was before. This is a complete no-no. But what we'll learn to do in time is to combine, to find better ways to combine the music which appeals to greater masses of people or to younger people with music which is more, say, sophisticated or more artistic. We will learn to combine the solo pieces that you have to listen to and the music that you want to sing, and not like in this Westchester County synagogue, they pride themselves that the congregation sings from the beginning of to the end of the service, no stop. Now, for me, that is not a very good thing. Yeah, there's a Shira B'Tzibur all the time. And because of that, you need to have these melodies that are repetitious all the time. So this is going to have to be more varied and more a combination of old and new, of young and old, music of rhythmical and music which is completely different kind of recitatives and so on and so forth. So I do hope that in time this will be stabilized. But until that happens, it will take a while.
Wait until I become perfect.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the survey of American synagogue music.